wobbling that gavel. Welcome. We'll call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 4th of February. We have, as usual in this committee, we have a full agenda for the day. So I don't know if we'll get through everything today, but we are going to do our best. So we are going to finish up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1517. That's going to be the first thing that we do, and that's carried over from yesterday. Then, so long as the folks that are here for Senate Bill 1529 are very concise and brief, we will do Senate Bill 1529 public hearing, and if everything's smooth, then we may be able to work it as well, if the members of this committee feel comfortable with that. And then we'll be opening up the public hearing on Senate Bill 1530, the suction dredge bill. And we will do our best to get through everybody that came for the suction dredge bill, that came from a distance, to get through all that testimony today, because I know that a lot of people had to drive a fair amount of distance to get here. So with that, we're going to open up public hearing on Senate Bill 1517, and we're going to call forward some folks that hadn't testified yet from last night. Dan Moeller, Jim McCauley, Peggy Lynch, and Tom Wolf. And then on deck for that bill, up next would be Tammy Denny, Dave Honeycutt, Phil Donovan, and Rich Angstrom. And just because you're coming up in panels does not mean that you guys are necessarily of all of the same opinion. So,
I used to live in Washington County.
It's just how we're organizing people, you know, rotating forward quickly. So, and are we doing any of that for? Okay, not for that. Okay,
sure.
You're up.
Thank you. My name is Dan Moeller. I direct the conservation program for Metro's Parks and Nature Department. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and to explain why Metro opposes Senate Bill 1517. As you know, Metro is the regional government in the Portland metropolitan area, and in 1995 and 2006, voters approved bond measures to acquire land to protect natural resources and the impacts of growth, and specifically to improve water quality, fish and wildlife habitat. To date, Metro has acquired over 14,000 acres, all from willing sellers. And in 2013, the voters of the region approved a tax levy to allow us to restore the land that they asked us to acquire. I've already submitted my written testimony, so today I'm going to just plan to share a few comments and a couple of stories that I think will explain our position. I want to start by saying that the issues before us are not agriculture versus conservation issues. We've heard from both farmers and conservation advocates that agriculture, wetland habitat, and water quality are all critical to our economy and to our way of life. All of us care deeply about the land, and that's why we're here today. And all of us need to work together and want to work together to solve these important issues. Metro owns and leases over 1,200 acres of land in agriculture to over 20 farmers to produce crops for the Portland region and beyond. In fact, three-quarters of the farmland that Metro has purchased is still in agricultural production. And my team regularly meets with farmers to discuss opportunities for partnerships and also to discuss potential impacts of the work that we do on their operations. I had an interesting interaction this week with a couple of farmers that I met with out in Washington County, and what made me think of it were Senator Whitsitt's concerns that he expressed yesterday about the impact of waterfowl on cropland, something that farmers have to regularly deal with. And I initiated my conversation with those farmers this week to discuss a project that we're proposing, which will open up a forest that we manage to public access. I was specifically concerned about the impacts of opening that land to the agricultural production and just to their operations in Washington County. But during the conversation, a few things came up to wetlands that I learned and didn't anticipate. One of the things I thought was that the wetlands that we managed nearby were problematic to the farmers because they encouraged birds to come to the area, and ultimately the birds that came there ate the crops. And what came up when I asked one of the farmers specifically that question was that actually his concern was that our wetlands were actually taking birds from his property. This farmer, who's a legume, grass, and grain farmer, also to supplement his income, has a couple of ponds on his sites that he leases out for duck hunting. And because our properties or our wetlands have good food, they produce good food for the ducks and quality habitat, that they were actually impacting his ability to have quality duck hunting on his site. And so that was something that, you know, I always knew that wetlands were great habitat and provided great food for geese and ducks and other waterfowl, but I didn't really realize that they had the ability to actually pull waterfowl and geese and other birds away from agricultural land. I know the Metro and other conservation organizations regularly partner with farmers to conduct projects that benefit both the agricultural economy and habitat as well. A couple that we're just currently involved with that I thought I'd share is that we're working with a grass farmer out in Washington County to start to produce native Romer's fescue grass. It's seed that we will ultimately purchase, and other agencies who do prairie restoration will also purchase. While that's certainly excellent for our operations, it also does a couple of other things. It provides habitat for grassland birds, which are Oregon Conservation Strategy species of concern. And it also provides an additional buffer to the riparian area, which helps to filter sediment from the stream that may run off from other acres of the land that are actively tilled. We also partner with ranchers regularly to manage fuel loads on our property and create disturbance so we can plant flowering plants for our prairie restoration projects. And we also work with hay farmers to, again, reduce fuel loads. That is, you know, helpful for our operations, but also gives them material that they can ultimately sell. So we're regularly working to find ways that these two interests naturally fit together. Through the testimony last night and through many conversations I've had with farmers over the years, I know it's critical that farmers are able to actively clear their ditches to drain their land to maintain their crops and their operations. My family actually owns a farm in western Illinois that was once a wetland, and that was there was a hand-dug ditch known as the Winnebago Ditch that ultimately drained the land, and where hand-dug tiles were installed to make it productive, and today still produces corn and beans. I also know that we've heard directly that it's important that work on other lands don't impact farmers' operations, and that they're able to continue to operate their dairies and graze their cattle and grow their crops. I directly understand and appreciate these values and concerns. But that said, I believe that Senate Bill 1517 begins to address some of the issues that farmers are facing, but also has some unintended consequences that will be harmful to protecting wetlands and restoring fish and wildlife habitat. Specifically, the bill regulates wetland enhancements more restrictively than any other use permitted on EFU land. For example, our attorneys believe the bill would make it more difficult to restore a wetland than to build a winery, a church, or even a destination resort like Sun River. And I'm sure that wasn't the intention of those who crafted the bill. Also, the bill requires every wetland restoration project undergo a locally driven land use process that lacks objective standards, and this will make it difficult or impossible to predict which projects meet those local standards. This leaves Metro and similar programs vulnerable to the opinions of individuals or jurisdictions who may simply oppose our agency or conservation efforts for a variety of unrelated reasons, and I don't believe this was the intent of those who crafted the bill. Lastly, while making it easier for farmers to clear their ditches to protect their property, the bill simultaneously makes it possible for landowners of EFU land to remove fill from salmon-bearing streams to create something like a swimming hole, for example, or remove rocks or gravel without any oversight. We've actually had similar situations play out on properties that we manage along tributaries to the Clackamas River. And again, I don't believe this was the intention of those who crafted the bill. We recognize there are a number of issues that need to be addressed, and to allow the farming community to protect their farms and their ability to produce food, support jobs, and our economy. In attempting to address some of these, the bill has unintended consequences and creates barriers to restoring wetlands and exempts activities that are potentially harmful to water quality and fish and wildlife habitat from any review. Rushing this bill through a short session isn't the answer. We've heard from almost everyone who testified that we need to work together to solve these issues and keep our economy strong. Taking the time to bring the Farm Bureau together with the Department of State Lands, other conservation groups, and agencies will allow us to develop a lasting solution that will support both farming and conservation and not require multiple amendments and wasted time in the future to fix issues with the bill that weren't considered. For these reasons, Metro urges you not to advance this legislation, and we would be glad to participate in a collaborative process to work toward meeting everyone's needs. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Jim?
Chair Edwards, committee members, Jim McCauley representing Washington County as well as Clean Water Services. For those of you not familiar with Clean Water Services, that is the water resource agency in Washington County serving a little over 500,000 residents. So they're responsible for stormwater, flood management, water quality, and stream enhancement along with fish habitat improvement. It's also structurally set up as a county service district. So the oversight for the decision-making is actually with the county board. So the decision-making on projects, vision, all the planning and things of that nature goes through a relatively formal public input process. And I think that's important to lay out here in front of you because our issue with 1517 is narrow. I found myself, I think, sitting in the hearing last night thinking I was actually in the wrong committee room because much of what was described as concerns or the problems in Tillamook County is not part of what the business model in Washington County or how Clean Water Services functions and the importance of wetlands, mitigation, and all the enhancement programs have is directly actually tied to the permitting process that we have to go through or Clean Water Services go through for an NPDES as well as MS4 permits. So as an example, if you look at just the thermal load piece that's in our NPDES permit, over 50% of that thermal load is dependent on conservation measures. If we no longer have a current process that we have, it just becomes more additive and more difficult to obtain those type of permits the way 1517 is written. And that's really the crux of what our concern is on this. I think the helpful thing for me here in the last 24 hours has been to talk with all the proponents of the bill, and I truly do believe there is a way to try to navigate this bill, still allow us to utilize our existing process, but also try to satisfy the concerns laid out last night by the landowners and the farmers and stuff in Tillamook County, and I think that's critically important here moving forward on this bill. So I don't want to get in any more detail than that other than to say we're happy to work with the proponents. We have already engaged in some conversation, and I truly think there's a way to improve this and take care of really what our narrow concern is over our permitting process. Thank you.
Peggy.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government.
How many times a day do you say that?
Every time I'm before you, it is required by my board.
Okay. I've heard that so many times.
Good.
We've got
and you know
memorized.
What? And I still have to look it up to make sure I say it exactly correctly. As a part of that activity, the League has studied both land use issues and water issues. So this bill puts us in a real, gives us a real problem. The reason we signed on to the multi-group letter is because it's a value statement. It says that our land use system should reflect the equal value of wetlands and agricultural production. So we're concerned as we looked at this bill and we looked at the amendments that the processes offered simply don't meet that balance. Instead, it increases complexity and it causes more problems than resolving those problems. I know many of those farmers that showed up here last night and sat before the hearing And we talked about this this issue. And some of them said they were in that barn where you all got really wet last year. But what they told me was that there was no collaborative effort that happened afterwards, that everybody was in that barn and talked about how we needed to work together to solve the problem, but that process didn't happen. So we're asking that process happen. I just want to make another couple of comments, and that's wetlands is something I'm old enough to remember. They were called swamps, and we filled them because that's what we did with swamps. We now realize that they have ecological and economic value, and that's really important because it really is a cost measure for to clean our water rather than have to do some sort of infrastructure that for which we have to pay a great deal more. So we're willing to work on this. I think the last thing I want to say is we supported DSL's IT efforts to get permitting applications online. They need to fix the huck, or whatever that poor lady from Coos Bay, as she tried to fill out her permit application, had. So we certainly are willing to work with any of those kinds of things to solve the problem, but we believe that this bill and the amendments that have been offered aren't ready for prime time. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Moeller, I find it quite interesting that a government agency is now concerned about local control. And typically it's government agencies that add to the burden of local people to make decisions through rules and regulations that government agencies pass. It's quite interesting that we've got a group of folks that come in and say, we don't mind wetlands, we like wetlands, we just want to make sure when a wetland fails, someone is liable for the damage it does to my property. And that's where local control comes in. The folks in Tillamook County understand it totally. Folks in other counties come in and understand it totally how it works. My question to you then is that from your statement, it doesn't sound like you have any confidence in local control because there would be a diversity of different judgments as to what should be done. And one of the comments you said is if they don't like you, they won't let you do it. Well, you know, that's what we live with every day. So could you answer that, please?
Chairman Edwards, Senator Olson, thank you for the question. What I was talking about was that specifically not that we didn't have a problem with local control, but the bill simply lacks objective standards by which projects will be measured. And we are not comfortable with those lack of objective standards. It leaves a lot of room for interpretation, and it makes it very difficult to plan and predict which projects, you know, will be approved and which are possible.
Follow up?
Yeah.
When you say objective standards, it sounds like now you want more regulation, more weight piled on to being able to do a project, which makes it difficult for those people that are out in the boondocks, not in Metro, but out in the boondocks to do a project, to put together, maybe build a wetland or maybe clean a ditch. It sounds like that now you want more regulation so that local control will do things the way you want it done rather than what the local people want done. Is that, did I hear that correctly, or?
Chairman Edwards, Senator Olson, not exactly. No, I don't want more regulation, but for example, in the bill, I apologize, I don't have it in front of me, but a couple of the criteria by which projects are measured indicate that if there is, I think they say, a significant change in accepted practices or a significant change in, it's unclear to us what a significant change is. There's really not a measure in the bill that indicates what those significant changes are. So that leaves a lot of room for interpretation that we really don't feel comfortable with.
follow up?
Yeah. And if I may, and I think this might be what you're referring to, and I'll start with it's on page 2, and I know you don't have the bill in front of you, so I will read it for your record. If the local governing body or its designee finds that the use will not force a significant change in accepted farming or forest practice on surrounding lands devoted to farm or forest, or significantly increase the cost of accepted farming or forest practices on surrounding lands devoted to farm or forest use. Is that what you're referring to?
Senator Edwards, Senator Olson, yes, sir, it is.
Thank you. Follow-up?
Yeah.
Do we not probably have these in statute already, what are accepted farming and forest practices? And we can't define the word significant? Like, if you're going to bulldoze 1,000 acres, that would be significant?
Chairman Edwards, Senator Olson, I'm not sure I completely understand your question, but basically what I'm saying is that what that significant change would be is unclear. It's not clearly defined, and I think it needs to be.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Przanski.
Just listening to this, I think what I took away, you're looking to see objective criteria versus subjective criteria.
Chairman Edwards, Senator Przanski, that's what we are looking for, is objective criteria by which projects can be measured.
Okay, thank you.
Other comments? Okay. Thank you each for being here. Next up, as I had said earlier, Tammy Denny, Dave Honeycutt, Phil Donovan, and Rich Angstrom, if you could pull up another chair. All of you can get up there at the same. Actually, you know what? Why don't you just three of you go? And then, because Tom Wolf could go with the next panel. So
yeah, he'll want him by himself.
So,
poor Tom.
Rich, Dave, and Tammy, and then Tom can be up next with Phil Donovan, if Phil's here. So, okay.
I'm not certain, Chair Edwards, that I want to go first in front of these two because they might beat up on me afterwards. But for the record, Tammy Denny, I am the legislative director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. Simply want to let the committee know how much we appreciate as an association all of your effort to find a path forward to make this kind of legislation possible during this session. We support, as an association, Senate Bill 1517 as amended in the dash threes. We really appreciate all of the effort that has been given to this and attention given to this conversation, not just this session, but in previous sessions as well. So we understand that this is not an easy conversation necessarily, but it's necessary for those farmers that you heard from last night, and thank you for giving them so much attention last evening during a late session. Those Tillamook dairy farmers who you heard from last night had to report to milking parlor duty this morning somewhere around 3:30. So they had a long trip here, a trip home, and then an early morning this morning. I know you're putting in long hours as well, but there is nothing more hardworking than the dairy industry when they're reporting to their milking parlor at least twice a day and then feeding their crop, their herd, and harvesting their crops as well. So it's amazing that they stay in business, but the dairy industry in the state is valued at $650 million. That's 240 farms, $650 million worth of fluid milk production annually, as reported by the Department of Ag in 2014. Some years back, we had more than 1,000 dairies operating in the state of Oregon, and now we're down to 240. There must be some kind of path forward to address the issues that are called out in Senate Bill 1517 so that we can continue to give some sense of hope and certainty to our dairy operators so they understand that they've been heard and that when there is an issue, they have the ability to collaborate and to correct an issue like filling in a drainage ditch, especially in the Tillamook area where they are so tied to titles. And when those title pools affect their farms and when those ditches fill in, there needs to be a way for them to take care and mitigate those issues. When neighboring lands are bought up and they become another use for conservancy, nobody disagrees that that's a good use except for if it affects the neighbors. We have to find a way to have this conversation, and that conversation should be taken care of, and we should find a path forward before we adjourn sine die the first week in March. So thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. This is an important issue to our board member, Chad Allen. He's been working on it tirelessly in between his tour of milking parlor duty. So thank you so much. I appreciate your effort, and I appreciate your willingness to hear this issue. Thank you.
That's the first prediction on sine die that I've heard. So you just said the first week in March.
It's on the calendar.
No, I know. I was hoping we'd be out of here before then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, I've got two hats today. The development hat is through Oregonians in Action. I'm also representing the Oregon Mining Association today. We asked for amendments that resulted in the Dash 3, and I want to thank Ms. Nash and the Farm Bureau for working with us on the Dash 3s. What specifically we had concerns with the base bill for two reasons. Number one, on the development side, mitigation banks are an important wetland use outside of the urban growth boundary. And if you go outside of the urban growth boundary, as those of you have heard me talk about this before, 97% of the privately owned land outside of urban growth boundaries is farm or forest zoned. So the chances are, if you do a mitigation bank outside the UGB, it's going to be in a farm zone. Mitigation banks are important for development inside the boundary because it allows for development of parcels inside the urban growth boundary that have wetlands. You fill the wetlands there, you buy the mitigation credits, and you enhance a wetland outside the boundary. So it enables us on the development side to do development inside the boundary, which the land use system says that we're supposed to do. And if we had to satisfy these additional criteria for a mitigation bank outside the boundary, it would be tough. So we're thankful that there's been a carve out for mitigation banks. On the mining side, we also asked for a carve out for reclamation ponds in order to get an operating permit to mine. You're required in this state to have a reclamation plan approved by DOGAMI. The reclamation plan typically includes some type of reclamation pond. You dig a hole, you convert it into a wetland, and in order, if we couldn't get a reclamation pond, that we couldn't mine. And so a carve-out of this bill for reclamation ponds enables the mining, helps the mining community and enables us to carry forward with our activities, most of which obviously are going to occur outside the urban growth boundary and hence occur on land that's, if it's not federally owned, if it's privately owned, on land that's owned either for farm or forest use. So with those two exceptions and the Dash 3s, if the committee would is moving this bill, we'd urge the committee to adopt the Dash 3s, and we'd be fully supportive.
Thank you.
Good answer. Good afternoon. Rich Angstrom, president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. I'm going to be a little more technical because I'm speaking more for the record, the legislative record of what the carve-out for mining actually does. Locals regulate mining activity on EFU land under a sub-2 use under the land use rules. The local government set the post-mining use of the mine site. The post-mining use has to be set either as a sub-1 use, which is a farm use that wetlands are currently under, or a fish and wildlife habitat, or something of some public benefit. Typically, we use the sub-1 use wetlands as our reclamation plan. The mining and its post-mining use is a fairly extensive process that we go through, and the reclamation analysis is part of that analysis. So when we're going through the land use process as a sub-2 use, the reclamation is considered in all of that. It's all very intensely designed. The wetland impacts and things like that are going to be considered. There's adequate opportunity for the neighbors and others to comment on the reclamation plan before the local government sets the post-mining use. So it's a very extensive process that already contemplates much of what this bill does. The if we did not have the carve out, there would be a strong argument that we would have to go through a separate process for mining and then a separate process, local process for determining what the reclamation plan would be. So with that kind of technical legal stuff for the record, here's the example. When we mine, we certainly make a hole for the most part, right? And I mean, we all get that. When we're mining, and we'll set the post-mining use, and a lot of times that is going to be fish and wildlife. We dig a deep hole. We can't fill it all back up. So we get a lot of wetland development out on the edges of the pond, and we try to create a kind of a complex of pond, wetland, and upland complex. So it's a very nicely structured and thought out habitat. We also allow, because mining is sporadic and we move around, think of a 100-acre mine site. We have cells and we actually kind of spiral down for the simplest version of it. We spiral down, we mine a cell, we mine the next cell, we mine the next cell, we mine the next cell, and then we mine the first cell deeper, and then we go back around. Sometimes because of the way economics work and we're supplying so much material for roads and things like that, there's not a lot of money for those things. Those sites will sit for a period of time, and we encourage wetlands to, as an interim reclamation benefit, to come forward. So we want to make sure we protect not only the final design, but the interim reclamation objectives, allowing wetland and vegetative characteristics to take over the site until we get back around to mining again. We will also occasionally use the adjacent parcels of the property because we may, when we mine a site, have a donut-sized wetland that's in there that we have to mitigate for. We may develop a wetland immediately adjacent to that. This exception would allow us, because we're going through the process and they have to set the post-mining use and public has a chance to comment on it, it may be adjacent. It may not be just within the hole. It may be adjacent to the site also. And the last thing is sometimes we can't do that because, let's say, there could be an impact to an adjacent farmer or adjacent landowner. We're within a UGB and there's just no room to develop the wetland off-site. We'll use the mitigation banks, and we buy those credits. And just so folks know, those credits cost, at least the last time I looked at them, between $40,000 and $60,000 an acre. Now, I imagine the economy, I haven't tracked it recently, but the economy probably has played in that a little bit. It's very expensive to buy those. Running a whole separate process for mitigation banks would increase that process, we think, fairly significantly, and not a good idea to the development community that's already paying a pretty good premium. So we thank Senator Johnson for considering our comments on this, and we think that we're well thought out and reasoned. We really thank the Farm Bureau and Dave and others that helped draft the amendments. They did a great job, and we think it accomplishes the goals that we need from the industry. So with that, I thank the members of this committee of allowing me to put all of that on the record.
So for clarity, the dash threes
dash
represent
three.
That
yes.
that you just described.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. Senator Woodson.
A couple of quick questions. Dave, you testified for the need for establishing wetland mitigation and EFU facilities to facilitate urban development, and that is true. It's fair enough, but the rural areas are simply asking for the local authority to decide where those wetlands should be placed so that they impact, the negative impacts on their communities are minimized. Wouldn't you think that's fair?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I do, although I can tell you that the criteria in this, the irony is listening to folks talk about how difficult the criteria are in this bill. These are the same criteria that apply to all subsection 2 uses like churches and schools and things that I try and cite in rural areas all the time. So I've lived with these criteria for over 20 years now, and welcome to the party, fellas. Having said that, I do think that's – I agree with that. Senator Whitsitt, but at the same time, having worked with these criteria before, they're open enough that you can litigate these all day long. These criteria are difficult enough that they're subject to all kinds of litigation, and the you've got an important use with the mitigation banks that it seems to me is important enough because it carries out the one part of the land use system that we're supposed to that this whole system is predicated on, and that is that we'll develop inside the urban growth boundary. So it makes it harder for us to develop inside the urban growth boundary and harder to carry out essentially the very most important part of the land use planning system if the first time a farmer tries to create a mitigation bank, they have to go through the criteria that these criteria and get appealed from the local government level to LUBA, to the Oregon Court of Appeals, to the Oregon Supreme Court, and the like. So without the with this criteria, we think it will significantly impact the ability to create the mitigation banks. And from the testimony, it was the mitigation banks haven't been the source of the problem. And if we're not the source of the problem, and we and the mitigation banking carries out an important function for the land use planning system, why are we getting kicked in the head essentially for a problem that we haven't created?
Thank you. I was actually more addressing the in my mind the ODOT mitigation bank we had imposed in our area. But a question for Tammy.
Yeah.
I think you brought up a very poignant point, and that is that the dairymen were here. I grew up on a dairy in Central Oregon, and I know exactly what you're talking about. Those people were here last night. They're back working today. And yet we have a room full of people here, and not to demean them, but a room full of people here who are paid to testify. And those guys are back farming and making a living. And the disparity between the ability for a farmer or a rancher to protect their interest is growing larger every year. When I first started in veterinary medicine, the farmers and ranchers farmed and ranched. Now they spend a third of their time, sometimes half their time, going to meetings and hearings, trying to secure the right to continue to make a living. And I think that's what you were trying to get at.
Chair Edwards, committee, that's exactly our point. Is I have a history of working in natural resources for some time, and just fairly new to the livestock industry of dairy, and. Other than my grandparents having a very small couple of cows in the barn and a very small farm, my background as growing up was just that, was that quaint family farm operation. So I personally didn't have the opportunity to grow up on a dairy, but in hearing and working very closely with our dairy farmers, it's absolutely amazing to me how challenging their world is without the complexity that we then have them faced with in trying to figure out, okay, now how do I fill in the blank. And we were just down the hall in another hearing on another matter, and there were several farmers who took time to be here to talk about those issues as well. My first statement to our agricultural community is to be engaged and to be as involved as you possibly can. I was never so proud as to see that room, the room filled last night with the individuals who took time from their dairy operation to drive from Tillamook and then to take that windy road home at dark. But they came here already tired. They went home more tired, and they knew they were facing the milking parlor this morning. They still came. They still engaged because they feel so passionately about this issue, and it's not the first time. This isn't a new issue for them. This is something they've been dealing with. So we really appreciate your committee's time and attention and willing to have conversation, and we appreciate those who have come alongside of us and we're finding a way to move forward. And that's largely due in part to Marianne Nash and her commitment to this issue as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Yeah. To follow up on your comments, Tammy, the other thing I see in this, in going out to the farms and seeing the work they do, is the fact that they're not really asking any for anything extraordinary. They'd like protection from their farmland from wetlands. It seems to be very clear and very simple to me. If you want to build a wetland, that's absolutely fine. Everybody allows it. We have the rules to do it. But if you're going to do it, make sure that you don't impact the work that I do and the land that I own. That's what I see in this bill.
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, members of the committee, that is absolutely accurate. That is an accurate statement, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you each for being here.
Thank you.
And the final person to testify on this bill would be Tom Wolf. And then we're going to close the hearing on this bill and move on to the next bill.
Chair Edwards, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Travel Limit. I apologize for not being here earlier. I was up in a meeting. I just want to say I've sent in electronically my comments to list our concerns about this bill. We oppose this bill, but I just want to add two things. First of all, Trout Unlimited is a group nationwide that tries to always do collaborative efforts with local landowners, farmers, ranchers to work on their property. So I support the concept that we need to develop a better tool to include farmers and local government in this. I'm not sure that I believe that a legislative bill is the right answer. So if we could do some sort of work group with DSL or whoever is involved, we can do that. I'm just not sure that legislatively we could do that. Second of all, in addressing Senator Whitsitt's comments, I don't know if you're aware of this, but 25 years ago I decided to work on this issue and decided I didn't want to be tied to grants or anything, so I chose not to get paid. I work 60 hours a week doing this stuff and 20 hours a week as a history consultant that gives me enough money to afford to do this. So it is not true that all of us are highly paid. And that is my testimony. Thank you.
I don't know if he said highly paid. Senator Whitsitt.
You describe a legislator.
That's why whenever Senator Whitsitt, whenever anybody in my group starts to denigrate legislators, say, my goodness, do you realize how little they get paid? Mm-hmm. You know. So I defend you guys all the time. So.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Tom? Thanks for being here. And I almost forgot to ask for the governor's office to weigh in. So, Lori, if you could, I think you wanted to present an amendment or discuss the dash twos, maybe?
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. For the record, Lori Onan with Governor's Natural Resources Office. And I'll be very brief in the interest of time. I will talk about the dash two amendments that we submitted. Thank you for putting those in. But I really, really wanted to speak to you because I was here through the testimony last night, and I was very glad to see the people from Tillamook County were able to come and speak with you. And I just was reflecting on what I heard, the desire for meaningful local input, the importance of collaboration, the importance of agriculture and the environment, concern over how wetlands projects affect farming viability, and of course, frustration with processes that are hard to understand. And that is powerful. I just wanted to make the comment that we need to provide as government for transparent and understandable processes with meaningful public engagement. We want a thriving agricultural economy and healthy communities, but we also need healthy fish and wildlife habitat and clean water. And we want Oregon to control its destiny in managing fish and wildlife and the environment. And the reason I bring this up is I think one of the challenges in this bill, and we want to work for a path forward on the wetlands piece for sure. The challenge is finding the right balance. I just wanted to put on the record, you may be aware, Oregon is working hard to get a federal decision delisting Oregon Coast Coho. And when the federal folks are looking at our request that they be delisted, they're going to look at everything that we're doing in the state. Wetlands are important habitat for salmon. Salmon inhabit streams and ditches where there's removal fill. So we're just raising caution around those, kind of flagging that about, is this going to potentially set back our efforts? So just something that we're looking at. And again, we introduced the Dash 2 amendment seeking a path forward. We want to improve the opportunity for local public input. We want to make sure concerns are being addressed when those are developed. They need to be designed and constructed well and done right. But we don't want to stop or make unnecessarily burdensome these voluntary cooperative projects where they make sense. So given the deadlines, we submitted the Dash 2 amendments. We knew they were not totally baked. You don't even need to look at them because there's blanks in them, and we need to move on and work with folks to produce a new proposal. One thing I wanted to point out, we propose using the NRCS inventory data on wetlands, and that we found out that doesn't work. So just explaining that. So I do want to work with interested parties to find a path forward. Very much appreciate Marianne Nash's open dialogue with us on the bill. And then just really quickly, we thought that the wetlands process piece was the most important thing to deal with. The liability piece is important. The removal fill is important. There are issues that need to be resolved. They're all kind of big lifts with not a lot of time. So we focused on the wetlands piece, and that's the part we hope to make progress on. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And thank you for your engagement on the issue. You were one of the people that was over there in Tillamook on that rainy day.
I enjoyed it very much. It was a great tour, and I hope to be back and visit again.
Any questions for Lori?
Just one.
Oh, she's leaving.
you had talked about
you almost got
a collaborative effort. I wonder, did you collaborate with the dairymen and the other proponents of this bill in crafting this amendment?
Actually, Chair Edwards and Senator Witz, for the record, I did say we kind of tossed them in as a marker to say we're interested in the dialogue, but we kind of had a quick turnaround to kind of get them on the table. So we are talking with the Farm Bureau on a daily, more than once a day, about
so the answer would be no.
The amendments were not done with them yet.
All right. Thank you. All right. That's it for that bill. So we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1517. And we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1529. And so if the folks, and then Section Dredge is going to be, this is a very quick bill to dispatch of Senator Bates. So if the folks that are here for Senate Bill 1529 could come forward. Eric Cancellor, Tracy Rutten, and Mark Landauer. I don't know. Let's see. I don't see a Senator Hansel. This is Hanselsville? No.
Yeah, he did yesterday.
That's right. Senator Hansel testified yesterday. That's right. I was thinking I had heard this bill before. That's right.
That was
we took one day.
Yeah.
Previously.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
And just from what I just so you know, from what I've heard, I don't hear a lot of opposition to this bill. So the longer you talk, the worse your prospects get.
The more opposition. So.
Okay, Chair Edwards and members of the committee, I could go with good bill should pass. But for the record, Tracy Rutten with League of Oregon Cities, and we were actually just on the House side testifying on a similar but very different broader bill. That Representative Susan McClain has introduced on this issue. But we do want to thank Senator Hansel as well as Representative McClain for introduction of both of these bills. We understand and we do support Senate Bill 1529 with the Dash 1 amendments. There have been a number of conversations, we understand, with homeowners association groups. I've expressed some concerns over the House version of the bill. But from what I understand, are more comfortable with some of the triggers that exist within this bill and some of the sideboards that are included in the bill. We definitely appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation. 2015 was certainly a challenging year for water supply for all water users, not just municipalities alone. We received a number of phone calls from cities who had received phone calls from citizens that were concerned that they wished to do some conservation. But we're kind of stuck in the middle where there were HOA regulations that prohibited them from doing so. Our cities are certainly not wanting to be put in the position of playing referee in those scenarios. So we think that this bill is a good step in the right direction of a short-term tool that when certain triggers are met, such as a governor-declared drought, that it's very clear that we all need to do our part to conserve water. So with that, I will take any questions that you have or pass this along.
Okay, Eric.
All right, thank you. For the record, Eric Cancellor representing the City of Bend. I will simply echo what Ms. Rutten has said. I think she articulated the municipal perspective very well. As one member of LOC, I can speak and say that the City of Bend emphasizes water conservation. We emphasize monitoring all irrigation practices basically within the city to make sure that we are wasting as little water as possible. I won't go into the list of the things that we do, but if you're curious, I'd be happy to make that list available. The only point that I would add at this point is just to say that one of the principles that we think is really important for from the municipal perspective for managing expectations and public reactions in a drought or an emergency type scenario is to make sure that we can treat all of our citizens equally. So this bill would allow would help us avoid a situation where we have two different sets of our population expected to meet different standards that could create feuds and disagreement and inequities, and we'd like to avoid that. So I'll leave it at that and hand it over to, and of course clarify that we're very supportive of this legislation, and I'll hand it over to Mark.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer here on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. Our organizations are very supportive of Senate Bill 1529, including the Dash 1 amendments. The bill as drafted is a little open-ended in that the restrictions that would be permitted under the bill would not be lifted without the Dash 1 amendment, saying that once a declared drought has been lifted, that folks can go back to the situation they were before. Water irrigation of lawns and gardens in for municipal providers represents about 50% of water that is being consumed during the summertime months. So it's really critical for us, particularly when water is in shortage, to be able to ratchet back the amount of irrigation that's taking place in order to conserve that water for human consumption and for industry and that nature. So we commend this bill. We thank Senator Hansel for working with us to reach this point. And we hope that the committee will move this bill along in the process. Thank you very much, and happy to answer any questions.
Also with the Dash 1 yes. amendment. Okay, both.
Yes.
Okay. Questions for this panel?
Yeah. So, you know, in terms of the differences between the two bills, the one here and the other, one of the issues I heard raised was condos. Does the other one deal with condos, and why are condos left out of this?
Chair Edwards and Senator Dembro, you are correct that the other one does, and quite frankly, it's a conversation we're open to having if there is a desire to include condos. I think the way that the bill was drafted, the initial complaints we'd heard were from an HOA perspective. We did indicate on the House side that we are committed to a more long-term discussion with the HOAs, and I would envision bringing in even some of the landscape contractor association groups to have conversations around, I think, more long-term strategies to address this issue. I think this one is a short-term and would help address issues that are more immediate.
Right. Thank you each.
Thank you.
Eugene Grant, Peggy Lynch, and Tom Wolf. And I will emphasize that brevity is appreciated because I think this committee is ready to work this bill. So,
Senator Edwards and members of the committee, I'm Eugene Grant. I'm on here on behalf of the Condominium HOA Working Group, which supports the bill with the Dash 1 amendments. And I just want to emphasize the importance of those Dash 1 amendments because that allows our group to work with Representative McLean on a long-term solution that will eventually convert all homeowner association landscaping to water conservation, non-irrigated or minimal irrigated. We also would have no objection to this bill being amended to cover condominium associations during droughts as well. That's no problem. But we appreciate the importance of this bill, and we are committed to working with Representative McLean and coming up with a much more expanded version of her House Bill 4090 to produce a long-term solution that will actually create much more water conservation than she really would have achieved through her bill as originally written. Thank you.
Great news. Peggy Lynch, the unpaid volunteer League of Women Voters representative who has milked cows in the past. Good bill should pass, and I'm excited to see that maybe on the House side we can get the condos added to this. Go for it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. You have my electronic comments. I had a few concern about that this should be broadened, but from what I hear, the Dash 1 amendments deal with that. We hope that this is a great bill. We hope that it passes because we believe that people who live in homeowners associations should have a choice on whether to water their lawn or not in this current drought situation that looks like it's going to go on for a long time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you each. Questions for the panel?
Nope.
All right. Thank you each. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1529. We're going to open up a public work or a work session on Senate Bill 1529.
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 1/28/2016.
Senator Olson has moved the Dash to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 1/28/2016. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Are there any objections? Okay, seeing no objections, the motion carries.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 1529 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson has moved Senate Bill 1529 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? So what's it?
First, Mr. Chair, I need to declare a potential conflict of interest. My family owns properties within several homeowners associations. I understand the conflict that this bill is attempting to address, but homeowners association covenants are legally binding contracts voluntarily entered into by property owners to help ensure property values. One of the basic tenets of most of the contractual binding covenants is the requirement to maintain lawns, trees, shrubberies, and so forth to keep property values up. Both the Oregon and the United States Constitution specifically prohibit government action that materially alters private contracts. This bill materially alters a basic tenet of those contracts. While the Dash 1 amendment serves to limit the degree of the interference, the bill continues to do that. And I fully expect this bill to pass, but I will vote no because I do not believe this legislative assembly has the authority to enact this bill.
Thank you for your input and comments. Senator Prezonsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that this will not have a direct impact on existing contracts. It's my understanding, at least I believe, that it's actually for going forward for new contractual relationships.
I understand it's for existing ones.
Okay.
Perhaps we should clarify that.
If the committee wants clarification from Legislative Council, we certainly could.
We can go ahead and vote on that.
Okay.
I'll see to this clarification.
Okay.
I think there's a point that's been raised, and to me, it's actually trying to break contractual relationships and agreements, then I would like to have that on the record before we vote. Because, I mean, there's merit to that.
So why don't we do this? Why don't we? Let's see. Would we recess the work session? We can await Legislative Council, and then we can get started with the next bill. Would that be acceptable to the committee members?
Mr. Chair, I'm fine either way.
Okay.
I'm not.
Okay, yeah. The judicial, chair.
There's a point that's been raised as to us potentially trying to breach a contracts that are in existence. If that's the case, then I would want to ponder what another alternative is.
Sure, okay. So we are going to... I guess we can recess. I've never had to recess a work session. I've only recessed the committee. But we can recess a work session. Okay, so we're going to
recess.
So
right.
the work session, which is a situation I've never faced before as a chair. The work session is in recess. I'm going to tap the gavel to make it official. And now we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1530. Senator Bates. Would you start us off here? And I'd like to say that this issue, I mean, we've had this particular issue has been before us. This is the third legislative session in a row. I think it's the third in a row. Second row, long session. Yeah, no, we had it before last session too. So there are strongly held opinions about this issue on both sides. I'm simply going to ask that people be respectful of one another and the public process. We are going to do our best to give everybody an opportunity to speak on this, and we'll see where we come out. So, and we are going to be after Senator Bates introduces the bill. The vice chair is going to be exercising his right to swear people in, and so I have a statement when we've done this in the past, so that everybody understands what their rights are. And he will be electing to do that after Senator Bates presents the bill. So Oregon's legislature is one of the most open and inclusive in the nation. We hold public hearings on each of our bills and seek input from the public in our committee process. We depend on all the information provided to us by the citizens of Oregon. No one can tell us better how the laws we pass affect the people of our state. All we expect in return for your help is that you respect the members of this committee, respect the legislative process, and that you tell us the truth. Whether you are another member of the Legislative Assembly, the director of an agency, a lobbyist, or a member of the general public, we expect for your testimony to be truthful. However, I am concerned that the practice of swearing in witnesses could have a chilling effect on the willingness of everyday Oregonians to participate in the process of making their laws. For that reason, I want to address those of you planning on coming before this committee. The vice chair of the committee is within his rights to swear you in. However, you have rights too. You do not have to swear an oath. You can walk away if you choose. You can choose to have an attorney present with you. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights, including the right not to give testimony against yourself. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say to this committee, whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. If you testify under oath and do not tell the truth, you could be charged with the crime of perjury. Perjury is a Class C felony and carries a maximum possible sentence of 5 years imprisonment, a $125,000 fine, or both. It is up to the Marion County District Attorney, however, whether to proceed with any charges for perjury. So having made that statement to all those here today, Senator Bates, you want to kick us off?
Not anymore.
I'm sure you'll be fine because you always tell the truth.
I've had divorce attorneys tell me that too. Mr. Chair and committee members, I plan to walk you through the bill very quickly. Then Shigami will come up and talk about first sections.
Name for the record.
Richard Rigsby. Well, he's the vice president.
No, I'm sorry. Your name for the record.
Oh, Senator Bates, Senator from Southern Oregon. So in broad terms, I'm going to walk you through the bill real quickly and then bring people up to discuss it and have a chance for the minors to give their side of the story also. Presently in the state, because of our legislation we've done previously, we have a moratorium right now that goes till 2021 on suction dredge mining and essential salmonoid habitat. That's in place now. The real effective will be this summer. So the bill itself speaks to the following. Section 1 was a request by the mining community to ask the state agencies, that's the Department of State Lands, Department of Environmental Quality, ODFW, and DAGAMI, to coordinate with the federal mining agencies regarding permitting as much as possible. I should also say at this point, they are doing this to a great degree now. We ask for more coordination and simplification of those processes if possible. And I also should tell you that the state agencies are neutral on this bill, and you should realize that if you bring them up for discussion or ask them questions. The first section, section 2 through 8, concerns upland mining. Now, you may not know what that is. Upland mining is essentially in areas 100 yards above the high water mark. What this section does is lifts the moratorium on upland and allows Dugami to set rules and set a fee structure for monitoring these activities. Section 9 through 14 addresses the issues of the moratorium and the issues covered by the moratorium, including the simplification of permitting process. It maintains the moratorium until 2021 as it is now, and gives time for DEQ to do the necessary rulemaking necessary to determine what will be protected, how it will be protected after the moratorium is lifted. Advocates will give you more on this. It also clarifies issues concerning tribal lands and a waiver process for suction dredge miners. This is included in the legislation. There is a process for them to go through if they want an exception to the rules developed by DEQ. The last section is operative dates for Dugami and the remaining act. The Dash 1 amendments, which you will see with this, clarifies that biological resource habitat defined in the bill is in fact covered by the moratorium, and the tributaries of these sensitive areas are also covered. You'll hear that biological resource habitat includes a salmon, steelhead, as you would expect. It also includes endangered bull trout, the endangered Pacific lamprey, which are particularly important to tribal people. So that's a rough overview of it. We'll have two groups come up and talk to you and give you more details on it. And the opposition will have an opportunity, of course, also to do this. I have to apologize. I've got my own two bills up at the same time with two different committees. They're both very complex, so I'll be bouncing in and out as we go through this. So I will step aside now, if you would allow me to, and allow Dugami to come up and then the advocates for the bill.
Can we add, do you have time for a question, or are you got
to
go?
Do I need to be sworn in?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes.
If you would have needed to be, I would have had it done. You sat right next to me when this all started. And it was rather interesting because we had what I would call a plethora, a tsunami wave of California placer miners that came to our state because they were essentially run out of their state. And it was a social problem. We talked about drift boats and rafters and swimmers and jet boats and all of that stuff. And this enormous number of miners came to our state and caused a real problem for the folks in our state. So my question to you, good Senator, is how did we get from trying to minimize the impact of these guys to basically almost putting our entire state off limits to any type of mining?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, this bill really, in my mind, does not put the whole state off limits. It continues the essential salmonoid habitat protections, which were already in place, and it also extends those to cover a few other species. It does affect some waters that have mineralization more than others, and we knew that. Some of the work we did in the previous bill really helped out the issues you're talking about, to be perfectly honest. Separating the miners more, requiring certain things from them helped out. The drop in gold price helped out. We're seeing fewer miners now, I believe, than before. At least the permitting appears to show that. We don't know that for sure. So some of the work that's been done already has helped out. I've had landowners and other water users thank me for the work done. This does not mean there's a complete moratorium, as some states have done, saying you can't have any suction dredge mining at all. That's still going on in California. They still call it, I think, temporary. I'll have to check that for you exactly. And other areas are being closed down completely. This bill does not do that. We're trying to protect those areas of the rivers that are really sensitive to and endangered by what we think suction dredge mining does. So I understand your concerns, and that a lot of work has been done. It can be characterized the way you've spoken to it, but I don't believe that's the reality, as my understanding of this is.
A fellow?
Yeah.
Would it be more appropriate if I asked someone else, but doesn't this really expand? Could you tell me how much more water and acreage or is it in this bill?
This is an expansion. When the mapping is completed, I'll be able to tell you more about exactly what that expansion is. That's why it's important that we do this work before the moratorium is lifted, so we can have a better understanding of what we're doing here. There will be other, you know, chances to deal with this in the future. I hate to tell the chair this, but we may be seeing more of this as once the maps are completed, the DEQ completes its rulemaking. We'll be looking at that, obviously, again, to make sure that we've done it properly and as much as possible come to a consensus, which in this particular situation, I don't think we're actually going to reach a consensus, but it may be something that people will live with.
All right. Thank you for bringing this issue forward. And you've got other stuff to go do, I know. So,
Mr. Chair, I think your last statement would probably saying that thank you for bringing it forward would probably put you in perjury, but thank you.
Okay, so next we'd like to hear from Dogami. So, Richard Briggs.
Thank you, Chair Edwards. Committee members, I'm Richard Riggs, Assistant Director for the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and the head of the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. You've heard Senator Bates describe the background of the bill and go through some of the easier sections, like Section 1, where we have to coordinate our operations with federal authorities. I won't talk about those things as much. I'll talk more about the upland provisions as they apply to Dogami and future mining activity in the state. Section 2 continues the in-stream suction dredge moratorium until 2021, but it removes the moratorium in the 100-yard upland zone, and that's the zone that Dogami would regulate in. Section 5 applies to non-aggregate placer mining activities in upland areas between the lines of ordinary high water and 100 yards perpendicular to the line of ordinary high water. Non-aggregate placer miners using motorized excavation equipment for site preparation and excavation inside this 100-yard upland zone will be required to get a Dogami permit. Section 6 codifies Dogami's ability to condition permits based on tribal input. We currently circulate all our permits, amendments, transfers, everything to the tribes under ORS 182-164. And this section of the bill really would not change our current operations or policy. Section 7 clarifies issues related to Dogami's exclusion certificates, which were created by House Bill 3563 in the last session. Under House Bill 3563, small-scale miners below statutory thresholds set by ORS 517-750 and 755 must obtain an exclusion certificate, and those thresholds are less than an acre per year, 5,000 cubic yards per year, or a total disturbance of 5 acres. So if they are below that, they would be required to get an exclusion certificate, or now they would be required to get an exclusion certificate and not be required to get an operating permit. This section, number 7, exempts miners that do not use motorized equipment for site preparation from this requirement to obtain an exclusion certificate. So if they're pick and shovel folks, we're not going to regulate them. We're not going to require them to register with us at all. And Section 8 just aligns Dogami's definition of small-scale mining with the federal law. So just in summary, before I conclude and make myself available for questions, Senate Bill 1530 does not apply to hobby or recreational miners using gold pans. Senate Bill 1530 does not affect current statutes for miners using motorized excavation equipment outside of the 100-yard upland zone. Senate Bill 1530 exempts from Dogami's exclusion certificate requirements all non-motorized activities. The bill allows mining in upland areas under Dogami permits, which is still the same as Senate Bill 838. And it ensures the water quality and riparian vegetation are protected in critical habitat areas through the Dogami permitting process. As a miner comes forward, applies for a permit, we circulate those to our partner agencies, tribal, federal partners, so that there are opportunities to comment and really vet the mine site and the operation, future reclamation activities, everything, so that we can protect those areas. Thank you again, Senator Edwards, for the opportunity to testify, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Questions for Richard?
Thank you.
Senator Whitsitt.
This bill speaks of aggregate and non-aggregate throughout. And in the search of the ORS, I cannot find a definition of aggregate.
So the...
Is there a statutory definition of aggregate that you can point us to?
Senator Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, there are definitions of minerals in our statutes under ORS 517, which includes aggregate, sand, gravel, clay, industrial minerals, things like that. But to actually a specific definition just for aggregate itself, there is not a definition. But
Would you find that sort of problematic since we're dividing between aggregate and non-aggregate and we don't have a definition of aggregate?
No, I do not, because Chair Edwards, Senator, what's it? The bill itself uses aggregate is what is used by in concrete. It's the gravel that's using the river rock that's using concrete and asphalt production. Non-aggregate is the material that would be trapped in that matrix of aggregate, the gold, the minerals that you're trying to get out. So when we say non-aggregate placer mining, there is aggregate placer mining, which is basically you dig out the rock and you screen it and wash it and sort it, and that would be aggregate placer mining. Non-aggregate would be you're ignoring the gravel, and you're focusing on the minerals that are inside the gold or the silver, whatever might be located there.
Also in the, and I'm sure it's in the text of the bill or in the amendment, it appears to the original Senate Bill 838 bill, whatever it was, addressed precious metals, gold and primary gold and silver. This bill now appears to address about 102 elements in the periodic table. Why the expansion?
Chair Edwards, Senator Whitsitt, I was not involved with the Senate Bill 838 working group. That was before I came to Dalgamie, so I cannot speak to the intention of that working group to only cover gold. Or what I can say is that this bill does not it does not specifically say all 102 elements. It does speak to non-aggregate, which would be things that are not gravel. The things that actually have more value than gravel that you would pull out of that matrix. I'm not trying to be smart. I'm just trying to answer your question, sir.
Well, I mean, I guess the point I was trying to make is that the original plan was to regulate gold and silver mining in in-stream placer, and now we're talking about everything. So.
Thank you, Mr. Riggs. With this expansion of areas that are unable to be used for mining, and with the added burden on you to make certain that everything goes right, what's the fiscal to Dalgamie going to be?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson. So the expansion, I believe you're speaking to the in-stream portion of the bill. Is that correct? Because that is not a Dalgamie regulated area.
Right, but we've expanded the entire area, including upland areas, so there's a large quantity of land that now will be included, which will be under your purview. So what's the fiscal going to be to Dalgamie?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, that area was always open to Dalgamie for mining activities. Under Senate Bill 838, miners could always apply for an operating permit and operate in that area. So it's really hard right now to say what a fiscal would be, because it really depends on how many miners come forward and decide to apply for an operating permit within that area. I can tell you right now, within my department, we have two vacant positions that we could easily fill and use to if there was a significant increase in workload, and so that would still be within our current authorization.
A follow-up?
Yeah.
So prior to a work session, if we have one on this bill, will you be prepared to tell us if there will be a fiscal and how much it will cost?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, if we had a very good estimate on the number of miners that would actually apply, then I could give you a better fiscal impact statement. However, that is an unknown number. We know, based on some permits that have been issued by DEQ and DSL, that we think that there might be hundreds, but we don't know for a fact how many would actually come forward and apply. But even if we had 200 or 300 came forward and apply, we would be able to plus our staff up in those vacant positions and address this issue pretty easily within our current authorization. The fiscal impact statement, I would be willing to, if I knew a hard number, I could tell you what a fiscal impact statement would be. And unfortunately, there's a little bit of unknown in this as far as the number of miners that will seek permits. I can give you an outside ballpark estimate to the very minimum a range, so to speak, for a fiscal impact statement. And I apologize that I can't do much better than that.
One last short question.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that outside of the 100-yard range, if it was non-motorized, there's no permit required. Is that correct?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, that is correct. So House Bill 3563 created the exclusion certificate requirement, and there was some uncertainty vagueness with the language. And the way the Department of Justice interpreted that was it would apply to all small-scale mining activities that were below those statutory thresholds that I spoke to earlier. And so what this bill does is it says that if you're a non-mechanized or non-motorized miner, regardless of where you're at, you would be exempt from our regulation.
A follow-up. Hypothetically, then, if 1,000 people went into an area 100 yards up and started with pick and shovel, they wouldn't need a permit, and they could do whatever they needed to. Is that correct?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, hypothetically, I guess that would be correct.
Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
I doubt it would be economic, though.
Thank you for being here. Okay. We have legislative counsel has come in on the last bill, so we're just going to leave the current hearing open, and then we're going to open back up the hearing on
work session.
Or the work session. Thank you. We're going to open back up the work session on Senate Bill 1529. And Ted, if you could, or either of you or both of you could come forward, Emily. And perhaps answer some questions from the committee. I don't know if you heard what the question at hand is on whether or not this bill interferes with existing contracts or would only be prospective.
I did hear. My name is Emily Moss. I'm from the Office of Legislative Counsel. I did hear the question, and the bill would impact existing and prospective contracts.
Follow up.
Okay. Yeah.
And on the what authority would we have to impact existing contracts? Is this under 10th Amendment rights for health and safety of the state, or how are we breaching that?
Yes, the Legislative Assembly does have police power over public health, safety, and welfare.
Could you speak up? Sorry, I couldn't hear
that. No. Could you speak into the mic a little bit?
Oh, sorry. The Legislative Assembly does have a police power over public health, safety, and welfare.
If I can just follow up. So basically what we're understanding is that by taking this vote, that because of the powers that are reserved under the 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the state does have the ability to interject in these particular situations that are set up forth. And I believe this is under Section 1, the sub 5, and I'm not sure if there's another number before that, but on page 3 is the new language that's being included. Starts on page 3, line 44, and continues on page 4 through line 7.
Senator Edwards, Senator Brzezinski, could you please repeat the question?
Yeah. So what we're referring to, we're inserting into and amending the existing statute, and starting on page 3 on line 44 and continuing on to page 4, line 7, is the new insertion, and this is where we were exercising that police power to allow for limitation of watering in a drought situation.
Senator Edwards, Senator Brzezinski, that is correct. This new boldface type, this is an exercise of that police power. And what it does is it empowers the homeowner to determine in a drought situation if they are going to follow the bylaw of the homeowners association requiring them to water their lawns.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Legislative Council? She's here. Okay. Thank you. So we're in work session on this bill. We have already adopted the Dash 1 amendments. Senator Olson had made a motion on the bill. And
You had
made a motion, and that's why we're in discussion.
I've moved.
Okay.
Discussion.
So we're still in discussion. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing for us to get clarity from the Legislative Council as to our authority to actually put this in place. I thought it was very important that it's in the record as to why and how we're doing this based on the statement that Senator Wissett had said before we took the vote. So thank you.
Thank you. Other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Are there objections? Okay, note for the record the objection of Senator Witsit. The motion carries. And Senator Hansel will carry the bill on the Senate floor. We will close the work session on Senate Bill 1529. Did I get that number right? Yep, Senate Bill 1529. And we will resume testimony on Senate Bill 1530. We're still in work or in public hearing. That bill. So next up, we've had Senator Bates has presented the bill. We've had Dogami has explained their role, and now we're going to do a panel of proponents and then a panel of opponents. And I am going to try to be, because I don't know that we'll get through everybody today, I'm going to try to be sensitive to people that have marked on the sheet that they live over 100 miles away so we can get through those folks today. Some people live right here in Salem, and some people don't live quite as far. I live in Eugene and whatnot, and then some people have driven a long way. So I will do my best. So first off, for panel of proponents, Forrest English and John Ward and Jonathan Mann. Please. I think we will be henceforth, Vice Chair would like to swear the panels in, so.
Please raise your right hand. Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do. Okay.
Thank you. And, sir, would you like for us?
I'm happy to go first.
Okay.
My name is Jonathan Manton. Thank you for having us today, Committee Chair Edwards. I represent Water Watch of Oregon and also do some consulting for a larger coalition. Many of the members are here today that's been working on this issue for quite a long time. So I want to start by thanking the agency folks and many stakeholders that are behind us in the room. We have been through quite a journey, as you all remember. Rich from Dogami, Karen at DEQ, Bill, DSL, Brett and Laurie in the governor's office, Russ, ODFW. We have been for several years working on, along with all the stakeholders, this issue. And so I just wanted to acknowledge all of their work and say that a large group of people appreciate how much time and energy has gone into this. I'll keep my comments really just brief. I think others can talk more about, a range of issues in the bill. We support the Dash 1 amendment. which would include the ESH and lamprey habitat plus the tributaries in the current moratorium. And I want to mention just that not everybody's going to get, if this bill was to move forward with the dash ones, there's still a lot of compromising that has happened to get here. This proposal is not a permanent statewide moratorium, as some members of the coalition would prefer. There is no cap on the number of permits to be issued after 2021, which earlier proposals and conversations had that in them. This moratorium and our understanding of some of the comments that were made before maybe a little different. So maybe we need to get legislative counsel to clarify exactly what the bill does, because my understanding of what the bill does with regard to the upland mining piece, I think, is a little different than what was stated before. And one of the kind of gives from our coalition was that for this moratorium that's in place now, the upland miners would not be included in that moratorium. They're taken out of the moratorium. And in replacing that 100-yard area is where Dogami comes in and would be issuing permits for that area. So they, whereas currently they're included in the moratorium, this will take them out of the moratorium. They would still need to be getting permit, of course, and the smaller ones, as was described, would not have to get a permit if they're doing this just a pick and shovel. My understanding is if they're operating with a motorized sluice in that area, they also don't need to get a Dogami permit. There would also, my understanding is that there's also an element of DEQ permitting in that area, but that was all worked out in conversations between the miners and the mining interests, and Dogami is my understanding. We thought that piece and believe this piece is part of us making a compromise with them, or accepting this as a compromise. We think that enforcement could have been stronger, but it's still not that strong. Having said that, and then, of course, the waiver that was mentioned earlier, if there's a belief that there's a regulatory taking, then DEQ would be able to find that as part of that waiver provision. These are all a number of things that we have been willing to have conversations on to get in the sense of compromise. We do believe this bill is a good long-term fix and support the bill with the dash one. The agencies have done, again, tremendous work with putting together the framework, which would kick in 2021. And this extensive process includes public mediation that we had as a study group. We met for a year as a study group. There were legislative hearings now going on for three sessions, and we believe it's time we resolve this issue for the long run. And so with the dash ones, we would be in support of this bill. And thank you very much for doing this again.
Thank you. Sir?
John Ward, the conservation chair for Rogue Fly Fishers, and I've been involved in this endeavor for 3 years, I think, now. I think the members of the Rogue Fly Fishers are very concerned about the impact that they've seen based on personal observation of the suction dredging activity in two ways in particular, but there are many others beyond that. And the first is the impact in taking the gravel beds and running them through the sluice box. The whole system results in the maceration of macroinvertebrates that are important food source for the fish of concern. Second thing is that some of the suction dredging activity has undermined restoration work in a significant way that the state and others, private individuals, have paid for, and that were intended to provide a habitat that was appropriate for the fish. And with that habitat being disturbed, the food source being disturbed, that it undermines the investment that was made in time and money to try to restore fishable, swimmable streams. That's my thought.
Thank you.
Senator Edwards, members of the committee, thanks very much for having us. My name is Forrest English. I'm the program director of Rogue Riverkeeper. I know that you've heard over the last several sessions a whole bunch about this, so I won't belabor those points too much. You know, I think the concerns of our organization, our members, are broadly water quality impacts and the impacts to fish and other aquatic organisms, particularly salmon. both to their habitat directly, you know, as well as changing the you know, physical components of the streams and rivers where the mining occurs. I guess I would just like to point out that I think the Dash 1 amendments of 1530 here are, you know, identifying a very critical role of using the temporary moratorium as a breather to give the agencies time to develop long-term solutions. And I think the solutions, there are some minimums outlined in the bill, but I think those solutions are walked quite a bit back from where many people and many environmental groups would like to be with, you know, a more permanent ban. You know, I think I would especially highlight that that is not what this bill is calling for. That it provides several, you know, steps backwards. It provides us a way that we can move forward for the long haul and not have to revisit this issue again. That it is targeting much more finely the areas where, you know, resources that people are concerned about, such as clean water and fisheries, are protected, while allowing for mining in other areas where that is appropriate. Obviously, there is some work the agencies will need to be doing during the remainder of the moratorium to develop those regulations, you know, which I think is why it's especially important that that moratorium, you know, finishes its 5 years, so that without the ongoing pressures of mining, those regulations can be developed in a thoughtful way. You know, I think that is essentially it, but I think you've seen a fair amount of public outcry on this, and I really look forward to, you know, putting this to bed, essentially, so that we can all move on and, you know, look towards implementing a new system and getting back to work under those new rules. So thanks very much.
Thank you. Questions for the panelists? Okay. Thank you each.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to call Scott Atkinson, Tom Quintel, and Mr. Cook, J.S. Cook. I'm not sure if that's a J.S. or a J.R.
It's just J. Cook.
J. Cook, okay. Before we get started, our staff will read the oath.
Will you please raise your right hand?
Let him go first. Oh, I'm sorry.
Under penalty,
he can't swear for you.
Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Yes.
All right. Sir, you want to kick it off?
Chairman Edwards and the committee, thank you for allowing us the opportunity to be here today. This has...
Name for the record.
I'm Scott Atkinson. I am a former federal employee. I'm a former member of Trout Unlimited. I'm a former commercial fisherman. I am a fly fisherman. I am a sport fisherman. And I started gold prospecting in 2006. One of the things that I did when I started prospecting was took a class through Clark PUD in Vancouver to understand the streams better. It's called the Stream Steward Program, and I took that class so that I could understand the morphology, I could understand the invertebrates, I could understand the hydrology in the areas that I was going to be prospecting in. And over the years, 10 years now, I've learned quite a bit about the streams that I never knew before when I was a sports fisherman at 10 years old. I understand now some of the problems that the fish groups are seeing. The streams are nutrient lacking. The eggs from the spawning fish don't have nutrients to feed them. Unfortunately, the miners have been the persons that the fingers are always pointed at. Years ago, it was the loggers. Years ago, before that, it was the ranchers and the farmers that plowed fields and filled in ditches. Unfortunately, we've been going at this for several years now. All of you are aware of the Senate Bill 838, Senate Bill 830. There was other bills before that. We've attended DQ meetings. I've attended DSL meetings. I've attended the turbidity study work groups. I was on the work group that developed the Washington State mining regulations called the Golden Fish Pamphlet, where we spent 2 years working to understand and accomplish all of the concerns from the tribes, from the environmental groups, from the federal groups, and we published the Golden Fish Pamphlet in 2009. 2 years ago, when we had the governor's work group, I presented copies to each member of that panel. I was told indirectly that I was not supposed to talk about the Washington regulations because they work. And then the people in the work group turned right around and referenced the California regulations, the California issues, the California moratorium. Last week I testified in Olympia against a mining, anti-mining bill, and the people from Trout Unlimited, first thing out of their mouth was, Oregon has a mining ban, California has a mining ban, Idaho has restrictions on mining, so Washington State is going to be flooded with miners coming to Washington because there's no regulations on the mining activities in Washington. If anybody remembers, that's the same chicken in the sky, or, you know, the sky is falling kind of thing that was made 2 years ago when Senate Bill 838 was introduced. All the people from California are going to flood into Oregon, and it's going to destroy our rivers and kill all our fish. It didn't happen. Senate Bill 838 put a moratorium or put a list restriction of 850 permits issued by DSL and DEQ. Both of the years after that, they didn't reach the 850 permits. In fact, I can be clarified, I'm not sure exact numbers, but DEQ issued the 700 permit, I think they had 449 permits issued. So the thousands of people that were going to come up from California and destroy the state of Oregon was smoke and mirrors. I have something that was just brought to my attention last week when I was in Olympia. It's called licensing liberty. No state shall convert a liberty into a license and charge a fee therefor. And that case was Murdoch versus Pennsylvania, and the reference is 319 U.S. 105. And the second item is, if a state converts a right, liberty, into a privilege, the citizen can ignore the license and fee and engage in the right or liberty with impunity. And the case on that law, it was Shuttlesworth versus the City of Birmingham, Alabama, and the reference is 373 U.S. 262. It's been brought to our attention since the lawsuits against DEQ were settled by certain groups, environmental groups, with the lawsuits against the miners. Those lawsuits enabled the environmental groups to have carte blanche access to the DEQ during their meetings for the development of permits. I was told, it's not personal knowledge, but I was told that in the development of this current bill, that the environmental groups were party to the development of the bill with the exclusion of the miners. The miners were not allowed to participate in some of these work groups. And so this bill that started out as 838 and then 830 and now is 1530-1, and I haven't seen the amendments, but I'm understanding that the mapping for the streams that are going to be covered has expanded considerably. And so what turned out to be a protective mining bill has turned into a Frankenstein. And that concerns all of the miners, that we have not had fair representation. And Tom can probably quote the ORS, Oregon Revised Standard Regulation, that says the miners are supposed to be consulted in any negotiations or laws and regulations
developed in the state of Oregon. I don't know if we're going to ever come to a solution because the environmental religion is difficult to combat. A Baptist minister and a Pentecostal minister both preach about Jesus Christ, but they both have their different opinions, and they both have their different ideas of how people are going to achieve their glory. So we as miners are willing to accept reasonable regulations, but a lot of these regulations that we're seeing now are not reasonable. They're not common sense regulations. And we petition a chance to have a more open review of why some of these rules were presented as a bill. And I thank you.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Good day to you, Mr. Chairman, and you, Mr. Olson. I contacted your office to talk with, you know, your constituents. This is the first time I've ever been here. My name is Jim Cook. My background, I have been a concrete batch man for Willamette Western when they were in business a long time ago. I was one of the six that were authorized, certified to pour the Glen Jackson Barrage. So I understand these aggregate miners, what they want to do. They need round rock to build strong structures. Crushed rock does not work for those folks. But these folks also are not going to go mining in the same areas that we're mining. They're out on the big river like Willamette in the Columbia. Their big dredges are not set up to go into these small streams, Illinois, Rogue, Applegate, wherever. They're not designed for that. So their mining issues are separate from ours. We need them, and we need that aggregate to build our bridges and our buildings, and I'm all for that. However, this bill, I believe, is unnecessary, as long as 838 also. And the reason for that is because, for one thing, we'll start out with all the miners that were supposed to come in the area and then did not. That's self-regulating. Just like if all of a sudden the price jumps up and you were allowing miners to come in and get their licenses or whatever or permits, it might fluctuate for a while. It would increase. However, because of the amount of gold that's left in our streams, most of those miners won't be making money, will be spending money, and will go away. It will automatically come back to where it was, like about right now. There's about 400 to 500 miners that really want to mine. I mean, there's so much more than that, but there's 400 or 500 of us that really want to go to work. Now, as far as destruction of the beds and stuff, I am also a fly fisherman and a fisherman, have been my whole life, and I see more destruction by fishermen walking out on the beds and destroying eggs than I do ever by miners. Miners were only allowed to be on the water for 3 months a year. During this time, the eggs should have already been hatched, and the little ones should be back on their way out to the ocean. The fishermen can go out there year-round and destroy the beds, and they do. Like the Deschutes River, I know that for a fact. That's one of my heartfelt places to go fishing. Mainly what I'm talking about is heartfelt issues because I'm not as educated as these two gentlemen are here. I'm really not. I've just started doing this. Now, my last little thing I'm going to say is I'm 66. When this moratorium is over, I'll be 72. I have served in Vietnam. I love my country. I always thought I'd be able to go out and mine on a small scale with my little 4-inch dredge. Now that I bought it, I can't even use the darn thing. I don't think that it's fair. We're not destroying the environment. If you've ever been dredging and you're underwater with your nozzle, in your own world down there, It is so peaceful, so quiet, so just, it fills you with tranquility. When you look out the ends of the dredge box, what do you see? You see fish lined up to do what? To eat. They're eating that algae and stuff that we're kicking up. The crawdads are eating that algae. That's what crawdads live on. Then what eats the crawdads? The fish. So all we're doing here is cleaning part of the river, since we're only allowed to move a small amount in these rivers and streams. We're not doing any destruction. We're really not. And it's really a shame that it's had to go this far for people like me to have to come in here and basically beg to let us lift the moratorium. Let's go back to work. By the time I'm 72, I have to have an operation real soon on my lower back. I don't know how it's going to go. I hope when I'm 72, I can still go out there. But thank you for your time, Mr. Edwards, Olson, and the rest of you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes, my name is Tom Quintel, and resident of Salem, Oregon. I've been mining some 30 years, and first I'd like to thank Senator Demro and Senator Boquist for attending some of the governor study group we had. I really appreciate that, because I think Senator Demro had an opportunity to see some of the equipment that we had.
Back up just a little bit from the mic.
Too far?
Okay. Distorting it.
Yeah. So bottom line, you know, it's pretty de minimis type equipment, 4-inch dredge. I think we had displayed there so you could see. One of the, I guess, biggest issues I have with the Senate Bill 838 and Senate Bill 1530 and the Dash 1 Amendment is the state of Oregon, for some reason, believes that they can override federal law. And we, of course, have a current lawsuit against the state right now for the moratorium. And you got Title 30, U.S. Code 22, lands open for purchase, and it's really plainly states that except as otherwise provided, all valuable mineral deposits in lands belonging to the United States, both surveyed and unsurveyed, shall be free and open to exploration and purchase in the lands in which they are found to occupation and purchase by citizens of the United States and those who have declared their intention to become such under regulations prescribed by law and according to customs and rules of mining association and districts and so forth, as so as not to be inconsistent with the laws of the United States. Now, I don't know how many of you have taken the time to read through DEQ 700 permit. This is a 15-page permit. You know, when I started mining 30 years ago, we had a 4- or 5-page permit, which then we thought was pretty excessive, but now we're up to 15 pages with fines up to $250,000. Now, for a de minimis activity that the Army Corps of Engineers won't even regulate 4-inch and less, this seems ridiculous to me, and I think the miners in Oregon feel pretty much the same way. I just, it's just beyond comprehension why when Senator Bass decided to get with the environmental groups and so forth, that he should be aware of ORS 517.125, and that's the consultation statute that requires state agencies and anyone who wants to affect the mining rights of Oregon citizens to consult with us before legislation or anything is brought before for new laws, and that goes with state agencies as well. For some reason, we're kind of out on the outskirts and never really get involved too much. A gentleman by Richard Enstrom actually wanted to try to form Oregon Mining Association to try to organize the mining groups together in Oregon so that we'd have a better voice for you folks, because you guys know him. And, you know, I've actually been involved in this for over 20 years with the legislature and with state agencies. And sat in a lot of meetings. I was a member of the governor's study group. And one of the things that bothered me so much about the governor's study group was that we have all these high fines. I see in here we've got a $2,000 fine now. Well, the only one that made sense in that whole group, and the only thing we compromised on with the environmental groups was, and the Indian tribes, is the state police officer that was representing OSP said, look, these rural communities don't have the money to support misdemeanor or jury trials. So why don't you allow us to issue a citation, like a game violation or some such thing as that, something reasonable that wouldn't require this for the depressed areas like we have in Josephine County and Baker and so forth. We all agreed on that. Believe it or not, that's the only thing we agreed on that I know of in this Oregon study group, governor study group. So here I see we got a $2,000 fine. I see we got a Class A misdemeanor. I just don't get why we're such criminals, and maybe that's the goal here, is to run mining out of business. Supposedly, we've got $100 million revenue here, and in the rural communities, it represents about $10 million. That includes everything that goes with mining in those areas. And I just wish you guys, excuse me for saying you guys and gals, but read this darn permit for Pete's sakes and see if you think this is appropriate for what we do for a de minimis activity. It's just unbelievable. And yet they want more. Now in this dash one, they want to take in more turf, intermittent streams that might affect essential salmon habitat. Where are we going to stop with this, is what I'm trying to say. I think the miners are saying enough is enough. And, you know, we believe in the 1872 mining law. I know the state agencies don't. The legislature folks apparently don't, because they voted this 838 in. We believe in that as much as we believe our Second Amendment right. And Congress gave that right for a purpose. It helped settle Oregon with funding, and California and so forth, and other states. And I just don't understand why you guys haven't had a chance to get into this a little deeper, understand it a little more thorough. I know the environmentalists want ban all mining. I mean, that's their religion. That's fine. But there is two sides to this story that I think you really need to consider. And I just plain oppose to 1530, 838, and dash one amendments on 1530. And if I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you for your testimony.
Sure.
Questions of the panel. So
I have
Senator Brzozinski, and then you, and then Senator Olson.
Okay, that's fine.
Gentlemen, a couple of you, I was listening to your last testimony as to what ORS 517125.
Correct.
I just put it up because I was trying to figure out what, in context, what it says is that rules to be adopted in consultation of affected parties. So I believe what that means is that if the agency or an agency is in the process of trying to adopt rules, that they need to consult, as compared to one of you suggested that because someone brought legislation, that they should have been consulting. And that's not what this stands for. Where the agencies are trying to adopt rules through the administrative rule procedure, that's where I think that applies, as compared to someone wanting to try to affect new legislation or amend existing legislation.
No, only the only reason that we mention this in the first place is that, well, I think it was last legislative session, we tried to improve that a little more. I know DSL thought that it was plenty adequate the way it is, and they kind of didn't want it. We wanted more scientific, peer-reviewed stuff brought in when consultation. They didn't feel it was necessary. I don't know about DEQ. As far as your legislative bills that you bring forth, all I said was that I think Senator Bates owes it to the miners to bring them into the discussion I don't think he thinks we're so radical that we can't sit down and talk to him, and that's why I bring that up. I think it can apply, even though the way you read the law there, it tends to apply to ORS and administrative rules from the agency standpoint, but what you do creates those rules that we have to live by. And so I think it does apply, and we're looking for common sense. We're not looking for, you know, something pie in the sky. We're looking for you guys to work with us and try not to kill the industry that's happening now. So I don't know.
Thank you.
Senator Olson?
Well, I just recall, because I've been here the entire time for Placer Miners, and I remember back when Senate Bill 838 was there, and we had the Deputy Director of Fish and Wildlife in the back of the room and wasn't called forward to testify. And one thing he said, the department believes that fish can generally withstand the occasional disturbance to habitats associated with motorized placer mining if it is conducted in a manner consistent with best management practices outlined in current statute and administrative rule. Now, had we followed that premise and that dictate, our miners would still be mining.
Exactly.
And that's the thing that bothers me, is the fact that now we've put a moratorium on them, and then now we're going to expand it to even farther. For 6 years we'll have the moratorium, and I can't understand why a state can't figure something out in 2 years or 1 year. We've already done this for two. So the question to you would be, was that statement that ODFW said true? And if it is, why didn't we take it? Why didn't we look at it back then?
Well, Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, we really have appreciated working with you. And to my knowledge, that statement almost has to be true. And I'll tell you what, if you get a hold of ODFW and you check the fish runs currently, the fish runs are higher than they've been for years. I mean, I've been all through Southern Oregon and all through, and the guides are thrilled. They're getting fish like crazy, even up north. So I believe this, that if mining was so bad, and we believe it's good because we take out the lead, we take out the batteries, the junk that's in the water, and if mining was so bad, why are the fish runs so good? And we're loosening up the gravel beds for the fish for spawning, because a lot of those have been impacted with, well, I'd say bad forest management practices, where the runoff has impacted the streams. We've got hard pack. If you folks would ever get in the water, you could see what we're working with. We're working with almost cement sometimes to get through the hard pack to get down to bedrock where the gold is. And you know, we look at as stream restoration, while the environmentalists look at it as stream destruction. And that is simply not true. And if they always say that we're bad, but I never see any real good documentation that proves that we are. And that's what I think we need to see before we make these laws that restrict yet another, I think, good commerce for Oregon. I just, I don't know. And another last thing I'll say is this. We're looking at $19 trillion government debt. And I said this in our governor's study group. I think you guys need us more than we need you, because that paper currency is gone. It truly is. You know it and I know it. And, you know, who's got the gold is going to win. I mean, so I don't know. This is how we feel about it, and I don't know what else we can say to convince you otherwise, other than use some common sense. And if you don't know what you're doing when you make this regulation, maybe it would be interesting for you to take the time, and we invite you to come down to our claims, the streams, see what we do, and maybe you'd have a different opinion of what you're hearing from the other side, is all we're saying. We used to do that. Oregon, OIM, used to invite the legislators down, BLM, DQ, different agencies to come down and look at what we do in the streams. We haven't done that. That's our problem. We haven't done that. I've offered it to a few members, but no takers. So I don't know what we can do to help you understand our issue any better. You know, my invitation is open anytime, any place. I think Senator Demarest almost said he might do it, but I haven't followed up with him, unfortunately.
Can't swim.
That was at our governor's state.
I'm still interested.
Oh, yeah, that's good.
Senator Whitsitt, you have a question.
Thank you. It was expressed earlier that this originally started as a social issue on the river between some miners and some fishermen or whatever. It was then extended to an environmental issue, allegedly to protect fish, even though the ODFW said that it doesn't harm fish. It was then extended to activities of upland placer miners. Then it was extended to include essential salmonid habitat. Then it was, this bill would create, I think, at least four other extensions. It would, it extends the effects on cultural resources, the newly coined biological resource areas, and now whichever amendment it is, to all the tributaries of the impacted rivers or streams. And it has gone from gold and silver to 102 elements.
Exactly right.
This feels more like an effort to exterminate the miners than it does to regulate the rivers or to fix the a problem that may or may not exist.
Yes, Senator Edwards and Chair Senator Whitsitt, you're right. We've added freshwater mussels, which in some streams we have none. We have lamprey now. We have stream morphology. We make a little hole that destroys the stream. We have lamprey. We have all salmonid habitat that we have to deal with. I mean, this thing has bloomed to a point where it's just about impossible to comply with, to be honest with you. It really has. And this is why I'm asking you folks to settle down, and before we do this stuff, get serious about seeing what we do before you make a rash decision and say, well, bye-bye, industry, next. It's not fair. It's not right. And people will probably not comply with it is the problem. And so you make criminals out of those people. And I don't think that's your intent. I really don't. So.
Other questions for the panel? All right. Thank you each for your heartfelt testimony and perspective on this issue. We have another proponent panel that has traveled from a long way away, so we're going to need four chairs, and then I will ask if there are any more opponents that have come from a long way away that I don't see on the sign-up list, and then we'll be done for the evening. Those folks that we didn't get to, we'll carry it over to our next meeting and resume, because there are some people yet to testify that work here in the Capitol on a fairly regular basis. So so next up, we've got Mark Sherwood and Richard Nawa and Robin Jansen and Charles Gehr. And I apologize if I didn't correctly pronounce any of your names. Administer an oath here first.
Will you please raise your right hand? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, for the record, I'm Mark Sherwood. I'm the Southern District Manager for the Native Fish Society, and I live in Brookings, Oregon. Chair Edwards, committee members, thank you so much for hearing testimony on this issue and on this bill. The Native Fish Society is a 501c conservation nonprofit. We advance the protection and recovery of wild native fish, and we promote the grassroots stewardship of the habitats that sustain those fish. NFS has 3,000 members and supporters, and we have 80 place-based volunteer river stewards who help safeguard their home waters across the Pacific Northwest. You know, if we go back to, you know, before the moratorium, if we don't do something in this five-year window that we have, you know, simply allowing suction dredge miners, you know, free rein to impact the habitats that are critical for our salmon, this flies in the face of the hundreds of millions of dollars Oregonians have invested in salmon habitat restoration in recent years. For their very survival, Oregon's wild native fish require clean water and healthy watersheds. Allowing miners to alter these habitats isn't only bad for the rivers and fish, it ignores the public's investment to protect and restore streams and their native fish runs. In our view, you know, while Senate Bill 1530 is far from an ideal bill, it doesn't permanently extend the ban or the moratorium. What it does is it provides a workable and balanced long-term solution for Oregon's wild fish and beloved rivers. For instance, 1530 would permanently protect essential salmon habitats, steelhead, bull trout, lamprey habitats, as well as provide protections for currently polluted streams. Governor Tom McCullough once said, Oregon is demure and lovely, and it ought to play a little hard to get. And I think Senate Bill 1530 does just that. It allows suction dredge mining in some of Oregon's streams while protecting our most critical and sensitive areas. Thank you for your time. And we strongly encourage the members of the committee to support Senate Bill 1530 and advance it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Edwards, members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. My name is Richard Nowa, and I'm here to speak as a citizen of Oregon. I support Senate Bill 1530 that would enact temporary prohibitions on motorized in-stream mining essential salmon habitat. I am highly qualified to give testimony because I have conducted research on salmon streams as a graduate research assistant at OSU. Specifically, I studied how stream beds move around in relation to disturbance. I am concerned because the damaging activities associated with suction dredging occur each year in some of the best salmon spawning habitat. Stream habitat cannot recover to full productivity when it's annually damaged by dredging. Since about 1992, I've been monitoring suction dredge activities, primarily in the Rogue Basin, and I've documented hundreds of instances where stream beds have been disturbed by suction dredging. These are not minor disturbances. These are significant. The miners dig holes up to 3 foot deep and leave tailing piles, and often they'll sequentially mine a stream so that there's a fairly large segment of the stream that's damaged. I'd like to address reproduction because reproduction is the most critical area or part of a animal's life history. If reproduction is harmed, it is extremely damaging. Just to digress a little bit, once fish are out of the gravel and their juveniles are adults, they can handle quite a bit of disturbance, pollution, that sort of thing. But when they're tiny embryos or eggs inside the stream bed, they're highly vulnerable to mortality. They have no defense, obviously. And what happens is the dredgers disturb these stream beds during the summer, and they're left in this disturbed state through the fall. And that's when the salmon come back to spawn. The salmon home to their natal stream, so they don't have a choice. They have to go back to these areas. When they get back there in the early fall and early winter, the stream beds are disturbed, and they spawn. They dig the reds. The female buries her eggs 15 to 30 inches into the stream bed. And when she does that in areas that are disturbed, scientists have found that the eggs are much more vulnerable to being buried by more sediment or scoured out. And so what it is, they say the egg to fry survival has decreased. And here's a published paper, I'm sure you're aware of it. It's published 1999, and fairly sophisticated study. And they found conclusively that when the salmon spawn in the area has been disturbed by the miners, there's more likely that the eggs will get washed out or buried. Also, I'd like to address this issue that the salmon are doing better. The coho salmon in the Rogue Basin, they're a listed species, and their populations are largely quantified by seines at Huntley Park. So they go out there, and every 2 weeks they seine the fish, and they get a count on the coho salmon. And the National Marine Fisheries Service, who are in charge of the recovery of coho salmon as a listed species, have done statistical analysis on those Huntley Park seines, and they're going down. going down. So despite our best efforts, the coho are declining in the Rogue Basin. And they have identified, the National Marine Fisheries Service have identified suction dredging, the recovery plan, is something that needs to be better regulated. And so that's why I'm here. I'm hoping for better regulation, just like the National Marine Fisheries Service. I have to understand that because we failed to protect coho salmon, the federal government had to step in and list them. And now the National Marine Fisheries Service are the biologists, the government biologists, that pretty much say what's what with the coho. They work in coordination with ODFW, but they are the experts, and they say the fish are going down. And suction dredging is one mortality factor. And it is common sense that if we know a human-caused mortality factor that we can take away, it's pretty obvious, I think, that we ought to do that. So I guess I just want to go back to this concept that once the stream beds are damaged by the dredgers in the summer, they can't be fixed. Sort of like Humpty Dumpty. They can't be fixed. And so when we go into spawning season, they're in that damaged state, and they're going to react differently to floods and things like that than if they weren't disturbed. So this common idea that the rivers just get somehow magically healed by a few storms is wrong. Science, pretty hard science, has proved that isn't correct. And this is, you know, an emerging thing. You know, what we knew back in the 50s and 60s is different now, and so we have to understand that we're in a different situation than we were in the 60s and 70s. We just said that all you got to do is just don't let the miners in there when the fish are spawning. That kind of made sense back then, but now we have a much more sophisticated understanding of what's going on. So that's all I have. Thank you.
Chair Edwards and members of the committee, my name is Robin Jansen, and let's scoot forward. I'm a river guide down in Southern Oregon, and I've been a guide for 19 years in that area, Northern California. I've been here before. I've talked about a lot of this before, so I'm really hoping I don't have to come back. But I'm going to speak a little bit to impacts on fish, as well as some of the other recreational economies, such as rafting and angling, specifically on the Rogue. And I'm kind of here today just representing those guides and outfitters that are also really concerned about this mining practice down on the Rogue, on the Illinois, on the Applegate, areas where people come from all over the country and actually all over the world to visit because they're beautiful and peaceful and quiet, and they have been impacted by this form of mining practice. In 2009, when the moratorium went in for California, we did see a huge influx of miners up in Oregon, and that was also coupled with the price of gold at the time that was much higher. So reports that we didn't see the influx are actually false. I was out on the river having to navigate rafts full of people around dredges, and it was actually posing a bit of a danger and kind of a risk factor that we weren't used to seeing on pretty mellow sections of river. You know, they cause a lot of noise. There was air pollution. Unfortunately, a couple bad apples here and there, kind of threatening people and yelling at folks. And so it really left a pretty bad taste in the mouth of a lot of outfitters and guides down in Southern Oregon. And so there is a big concern with some of these recreational outfitters around this practice. So I just want to be here kind of representing those folks and let you all know that I definitely urge you all to support SB 1530. I'm not for like all-out bans for things that I don't agree with, but I do think there's a way that we can and have tried to really work to come to a consensus, and that we really need to use our natural resources equally and fairly and wisely. And you know, fishermen pay pretty big fees for their licenses. That money goes back to restoration and enhancement of habitat for fish. Outfitters have to pay licensing fees and outfitting fees and have to abide by specific rules for every river that they run. So I do think that it's pretty fair to also require those types of things for this particular activity as well. So I am supportive of the bill and working on a better regulatory framework for the bill, as well as a solid fee structure to hopefully kind of mitigate some of the impacts to the rivers and the fish from this practice as well. Thank you.
Senator Edwards, members of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. For the record, my name is Charles Geer. I'm a booking agent for fly fishing trips throughout the United States, a fly fishing guide, and a resident of Southern Oregon. I'm urging the committee to vote in favor of Senate Bill 1530. You know, as a private avid angler and river boater, ensuring clean water, healthy runs of anadromous fish, and quality recreation experiences on our local rivers is important to me. As a fly fishing guide and as a booking agent for trips throughout the Pacific Northwest, I have a vested business interest in clean rivers and healthy populations of fish as well. The outdoor recreation industry is a major economic force in our state. I believe a much greater and more sustainable economic force than suction dredge mining. And I'm encouraging you to protect industries that are less extractive and pay for the cost of their own impacts, or to hopefully ask this industry to pay for the cost of their impacts. You know, the measures outlined in Senate Bill 1530 allow us to provide a framework that squarely addresses the worst of impacts to salmon and other sensitive aquatic species and their habitat, provides the state more sufficient resources to better manage the regulatory program, and it houses permitting under a single state agency. I believe it's critical to prohibit mining in sensitive species habitat in all streams with essential salmon habitat. We've witnessed the steady decline of wild salmon throughout Oregon for far too long. The state of Oregon is investing millions of dollars in restoring salmon habitat, yet currently allowing individuals to damage that habitat with a $25 mining permit. I pay more for a fishing license where I'm going to end up putting all wild fish back. I feel we must prohibit mining activity in areas where the state has invested more than $100,000 to restore salmon habitat. It seems common sense to me to ensure that permit fees for suction dredging substantially cover the cost of an effective program administered by the DEQ to analyze, issue, and enforce these regulations. Senate Bill 1530 gives us time to craft a fee structure that will require miners to pay their own costs of monitoring and enforcement on an activity that's affecting public resources. We're already aware of suction dredging's impact to water quality, which is why there are currently regulations in place pertaining to the length of their sediment plumes. We need to develop regulations that will place protections where they're needed, where they're most needed, specifically in streams with impaired water quality and essential salmon habitat. And to be clear, we're talking about 32% of Oregon's stream miles. This is not even close to the majority. There's plenty of room. This isn't an outright permanent ban. So for all these reasons, I strongly urge the committee to support passing Senate Bill 1530.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Olson.
First off, thank all of you for coming up. I know from Brookings that's a long drive. Be a long drive back this evening if you go this evening, so thank you for coming and talking about this. This is a very contentious issue, and one thing that always concerns me, Charles, you said this, that you have a much greater force. Always concerns me when one group of folks think that they're much better than somebody else and that other group should be eliminated. So my question to you is, what would happen if we came in and put a ban on you walking in the stream beds and fly fishing? If we have a declining run of coho, every time you catch a fish, you impact that run. So would it be okay for us to say no more fishing in that area because we want to improve the coho run?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Senator. I mean, if we can show that I'm participating in an activity that's directly detrimental to wild native fish in the state, then regulations or mitigative actions required are absolutely appropriate. I feel that, the fishing industry in Oregon attempts to pay for itself, to pay for either habitat improvement to pay for monitoring of the activity in order to offset its own impacts. And it's not that I feel that my industry is better. I feel it's more fiscally accountable for itself.
Well, I'm a fisherman also.
Yes, sir.
I don't fish for that little trashy thing. I fish for bass, and everybody knows that. The point being is that our fishing fees really don't cover all that we do. You know that, and I know that.
Sure.
And we get a lot of federal money to help to make things better. So it always concerns, like I said, it always concerns me when one group thinks that they're above another group because of an activity. So I'll ask you this, and ma'am, Robin, is it? Thank you very much. In the period when these folks are in the stream and they disrupt the bottom, shortly we'll have weather conditions like this, that we get a lot of flooding, a lot of influx of water. And this is when salmon typically move upstream, when we have that influx of water and they come in there and they spawn and they do the things they need to do. Doesn't this type of weather impact the bed of the stream as it moves debris, moves silt, moves logs and everything down the stream? Doesn't it do a similar type of, if you call it damage, doesn't it do the similar type of thing to the stream bed as what a suction miner would do?
Well, actually, it's my understanding, Senator, that with studies like the one Rich cited, that the disturbance from suction dredging causes a higher destabilization of the gravel than the natural movement due to water flow.
Yeah, thank you. And one more question, please, if you don't mind. Thank you. Mr. Nawa, have you put that document that you showed us into OLIS? Can you get that put into OLIS so we can read your scientific document?
Senator Olson, Chair Edwards, I sent a PDF to the hearings.
Okay,
website.
So it's already in? That was my question. Is that document you showed to us,
yeah,
is that in OLIS? That was there?
You could have.
You might not know what OLIS is.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. We have an Oregon Legislative Information System,
which is
supposed to tell us what
is it,
and we use it all the time, and it shows the bills and amendments.
Kelly's saying it's in.
Oh, good. It's in there. Thank you very much. Thank you, and thank you for the long trip.
All right. Any other questions?
All right.
Thank you each for being here. We have one last person to hear from, and then we are going to wrap up for the evening, and that's Frank Armendariz. I'm not sure if I pronounced the name right, but...
Frank Armendariz.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Chairman Edwards, I wear a prosthetic device. It doesn't allow me to raise my right hand, but I'd be willing to be sworn in.
Yeah.
Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you very much.
My name is Frank Armendariz. I live in Senator Edwards' district in North Eugene. I'm a river guide, and I sell river equipment, and I'm here to support the continuation of the ban on dredge mining, and particularly on the Rogue River. One of the previous opponents made a statement that I'm a little bit concerned about and wanted to bring some accuracy to it. Being a river guide, I know river guides, and quite honestly, a number of the guides that I work with on the Mackenzie River also guide on the Rogue River. and the fish runs are not great. In fact, if you look at the runs since we've actually even initiated this ban, they've actually declined. The last 5-6 years are all below the 10-year average for fall Chinook, and others have stated that those fall Chinook are probably impacted by the disturbance of the stream bed. But others have spoken more eloquently about the environmental issues. I want to talk about some of the business aspects of the Rogue River and how it ripples out from Curry and Josephine and Jackson counties and all the way into the southern Willamette Valley and into the little shop that I run in my garage and the office that I have in my home. I sell river equipment, and I've never sold a piece of equipment. It's specialized equipment. It's rafting frames, river dry boxes. Specifically, you would call it river expedition equipment. And one of the things that I've always encountered, or from all the folks that have bought equipment from me and over my entire career, which extends way back into the 80s, not a single one of my customers did not aspire to a Rogue River trip. Rogue River drainage opportunity, the Illinois, the Rogue itself, the variety of sections that are available, and it's always because of the wild and scenic designation and the pristine environment that we've worked so hard to ensure and to manage, even now under these times that we have incredible growth in our state, and we're also dealing with issues of climate change. I'm able to employ a few people. The equipment that I sell is mostly manufactured here in the Northwest, and it's cobbled by people who have small businesses like myself that make bags and throw lines and straps and all types of appliances that people use out on the river. So I wanted just to make sure that you all understand how significant the Rogue River is, not just to a small portion of our state, but how the economic value extends way beyond the bank and way beyond its estuary. That's mostly what I'd like to say. I did give testimony a couple of years ago. It was much more extensive. I'm sure you'll find it in the record. My name is Frank Armendariz. Again, thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah, I have one. Yeah. Thank you. I live on the Molalla River, and it's not part of really what we're talking about, although I think it's in the moratorium. I don't know if there's gold there. I've lived there a long time, and I haven't found any of it. The point I'd like to get to and ask you about is I've seen rafting trips down the rivers. I've seen rafting trips on the Clackamas River, all over the place. The miners have proven for what when they dredge up, they find fishing lures, they find lead, they find cans, they find all kind of stuff. So regardless of what anyone says in the rafting or the fly fishing community, you also have an impact on that fishery. So I'd ask you, don't you think that you have an impact? I'm comfortable with that. You make the frames and all that stuff, but don't you think that this work, these businesses that make their money off the Rogue River, also have an impact on what the fishery does and why it could be declining?
Well, I can't speak to specific businesses or individuals that and the manner that they conduct themselves within the outfitting business. I can tell you how I run my business, and I'll tell you that I do, in addition to sell gear, I do have a river guide business. I do trips on the Mackenzie River. I run between 30 and 50 people down the river every single day, 90 days a year, and I would dare anybody to find any trace of my activity behind me. And I think that's a more common occurrence now with modern day business ethics and the way that we approach the resource that we utilize, that we're able to make a really good living off of, that we pay our permit fees and we pay our taxes based on the money that we're able to make there.
Follow up.
Yeah.
So you're telling me as a fisherman you've never hung up a line and broken a line off in the river?
I can't say that I haven't. But I'll tell you, in my experience, no, it's not a very common occurrence, and I do, and every time I'm out there, I collect line that's been left by other people.
Well, see, now you just answered the question. You might not do it, but other people do, because people leave line in there.
I've seen fishermen pull strip line off to get to tie a new knot, fresh knot. The line doesn't go into a bag or into their pocket. It goes into the water.
Yeah.
So my point is that you also have an impact on the river. And the only concern that I have is the fact that we're picking off the low fruit. When is your turn to get knocked off the river?
I guess I don't understand the question, Senator.
Well, this moratorium takes the low fruit out, which is the placer minors.
Okay.
You could be next.
That might be. But I'm hoping that it would be based on the amount of science that a peer-reviewed science that we've invested into this legislation. I was here 2 years ago. The science was overwhelming at that time, and I'm sure you could go back and look at the record, and you'll see where it was, people who have more expertise than I do. I'm not a scientist. I'm a river guide. But to me, the science was adequate and telling.
One final question. You had mentioned that, and I'm not quite certain if the area you were talking about, there were no placer minors on, but you said even during the moratorium, the fish runs are declining.
But
so why would that be if the placer minors aren't there?
It's they were there before that. And salmon usually they're on a 2 or 3 year cycle. So the returns that we've had for the last 3 years would have been impacted in the time prior to the moratorium.
So
we're living those results right now.
Follow up. So yeah. if in the next 2 or 3 years, since it's a 6 year moratorium, if the fish runs don't improve, then that could possibly put you guys in jeopardy. Is that correct?
Possibly yes.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Just a brief question. I first, thank you for driving up. I know it's a long ways. I have a home.
I came from Eugene. It's not too far.
I'm sorry?
I came from Eugene. Not too far. But
okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. But I have floated the road from Shady Cove to Dodge Bridge, and mm-hmm. I fished above the, from Lost Creek to Shady Cove, and I have floated from Grants Pass to Graves Creek, and I've gone through the wilderness from Graves Creek to Paradise Lodge, and I've gone, jet boat from Gold Beach up to Paradise Lodge. I don't ever recall encountering a dredge mine operation. So I was wondering, how often do you actually conflict with them?
I don't have a business that actually is on the Rogue River. I sell equipment that ends up there. So in that sense, the river is very important to me. But I have been there as a recreational and private boater. And I have walked up from the main river itself and encountered folks that were at that time engaged in what wasn't a really legal activity. They were mining.
And when was that?
It's probably been in the last 10 years. Yeah, and I'll tell you one other story that where I encountered some mining activity that was incredibly inappropriate, literally in a Lane County park, at Armitage Park, which is just on the north edge of Eugene. It's one of our most pristine parks. But one day I pulled up there, and a couple of people had defeated a traffic barrier, gone around it, parked in a closed section of the park, and it gone down and it set up a sluicing activity on the edge of Armitage Park in the Mackenzie River. Now, I've never heard of any gold in the Mackenzie River ever, so just the inappropriateness of that was quite frankly stunning to me, and their notion that they were well within their rights to be in a Lane County park digging up a riverbank on a river that has listed fish was just a violation that was hard to fathom.
There is no legislation that will cure stupid.
Yeah.
If you're mining in a volcanic river, whatever.
All right. Thank you for coming up and giving your testimony.
Thanks, Senators. Thank you.
Thank you.
So We're done for the evening. There are people that are still signed up. We are going to repost the hearing for it's technically we're not carrying it over because we've already posted the agenda for Monday, so we're reposting this hearing, and we will continue taking testimony from people that had already signed up, not from people that show up on Monday that hadn't signed up previously, and just continue to stack our agenda up for the session. So with that, we are going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 1530. That will be reposted for Tuesday, next Tuesday, the 9th of February, and we are adjourned.
We don't get to do this tomorrow.
We are adjourned.